From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In gridlock on the partisan brink of default last summer, Washington's escape was to create a so-called super committee to go off and find cuts in the U.S. deficit. $1.2 trillion in cuts before Thanksgiving, or an axe would come down across the board on federal spending, defense spending, social spending, everything. Six Democrats, six Republicans locked in a room. Now time's almost up. Will they pull a rabbit out of the hat or fail? This hour on Point, American deficit and the final days of the super committee. You can join the conversation. Will they do it? Will Republicans give too much, too little on taxes? Will Democrats give too much, too little on entitlements? Do we have the will and skill to solve our American deficit problem? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. A special welcome today to our newest listeners on WBEZ, Chicago Public Media. We're very glad you're here. Joining me first today from Washington is Felicia Sanmez, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. She writes the Two Chambers blog. She's been tracking the work of the Super Committee. Felicia, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Listen with us for just a second to Felicia, to just a little bit of what we heard last year. Here was former White House chief of staff and a guy who was tasked at one point to find big deficit cutting measures, Erskine Bowles, advising the committee to find not $1.2 trillion, but $4 trillion in deficit reduction.
We didn't make the $4 trillion number up because the number four bus rode down the street. $4 trillion is not the maximum amount we need to reduce the deficit. It's not the ideal amount. It is the minimum amount we need to reduce the deficit in order to stabilize the debt and get it on a downward path as a percent of GDP.
Erskine Bowles of Simpson Bowles, the big plan that came out last year. Alan Simpson was there as well. Former Republican senator spelled out what he thinks will happen if the committee fails to come up with an agreement.
The market will call the shots from now on. Won't need anything but that. The interest rates will go up. Inflation will go up by the failure. And guess who gets hurt? The little guy. The vulnerable guy that everybody babbles about day and night will be the one hit with the hammer on the schnoz. So remember the definition of politics. In politics, there are no right answers. Only a continuum flow of compromises among groups, resulting in a changing, cloudy, and ambiguous series of public decisions where appetite and ambition compete openly with knowledge and wisdom.
Count on Simpson to put a colorful curl on it, but it's serious business. And Felicia, here, you heard this last week, I'm sure. Here, Erskine Bowles left the committee with this warning.
I know most of you. I've worked closely with almost all of you on both sides of the aisle. I have great respect for each of you individually, but collectively, I'm worried you're going to fail the country.
Erskine Bowles last week. Felicia Sanmez is covering it all for The Washington Post. Felicia, what's going on in there? Is there some way, somehow, that they may be on a path to a big plan, a big compromise, or not? Can you tell?
Well, actually, it's quite hard to tell right now what's happening. Members on both sides of the aisle have been meeting in smaller groups and as well as in the larger group, which has met five times so far since it's been created. But really, it should come as no surprise to anyone that the committee right now is still deadlocked. When this panel was created by the debt ceiling legislation in August, one of the things that was debated was how should these 12 members be chosen? And it ended up that the leaders of each party in each chamber delegated their members to this committee. And as a result, they are still deadlocked over the same philosophical big ticket issues that have really marked this whole spending debate from the start: taxes, revenue increases, and entitlement reform. So really, they are still fighting over those same things that they were fighting over this summer.
But wasn't the idea that we were on the brink, that we were about to push the economy default, everything right over the edge? This was the way out of that. If they didn't, we'd be in trouble. And isn't there a sort of Damocles hanging over this? If they don't do it, cuts all over the place.
Yes, and as you well know, and as we've seen throughout this whole Congress really isn't able to get big things done unless there's a big stick there. We've seen it with the three trade deals that happened last month. The only reason those got passed in the end by both chambers was because the South Korean president was coming, and that would have been a big diplomatic faux pas if those hadn't gone through. We've seen it with renewals of the government funding bills several times over the past year. And we've seen it with the debt ceiling, that agreement got hammered out only when there was really the specter of default looming. So again, with this debt supercommittee, the difference here is that, yes, there is that sort of Damocles, but not everyone views it in the same way. There was a moment last week when the minority leader in the House, Nancy Pelosi, came out and basically said it would be a disappointment if the supercommittee fails to reach its $1.2 trillion in deficit savings. But it wouldn't be a complete failure because, as we know, this trigger is going to be pulled if they do come up short. And that would include an across-the-board spending cut. So some Democrats are sort of downplaying the effect that a failure would have. And on the other side of the coin, you have some Republican defense hawks who are saying that this across-the-board cut would include some really big cuts to defense spending, and that would be unacceptable.
And of course, as designed, it would include those cuts to defense spending, right? I mean, describe for us what would happen. I thought the idea was that the hit taken by social programs and by the Pentagon would be so severe, it's sort of in the Democrats' camp, in the Republicans' camp, that neither party could take it. Now, are both parties saying, we'll just take the hit, we'll just let those cuts go, you know, willy-nilly across the board? Or are the Republicans going to try and unplug the Pentagon cuts so they won't actually happen? Could Democrats do that too? Could the whole thing fall apart?
Well, you're absolutely hearing some different things from both sides. Grover Norquist, the president of Americans for Tax Reform, and he's been a major player in the whole fight over whether revenue increases should be included in any final plan. He was interviewed last week and basically said that if the trigger is pulled, it wouldn't be the end of the world because he's in favor of these defense cuts at the Pentagon. So you have some members of the Republican Party like him who are saying this would not be disastrous. Others, such as John McCain, John Kyle, who's a member of the Supercommittee, and Buck McKeon, the House Armed Services Chairman, basically saying that they're going to fight as hard as they possibly can in order to undo this trigger. It remains to be seen whether that's actually done because if the committee does fail, and we'll find out in about 16 days or so, the only way they'd be able to undo this across-the-board cut would be basically if they all come back to the table and those big issues are still going to be there. So it's hard to see how it's more likely for them to come to an agreement a few months down the line compared to, you know, in the next 2 weeks or so.
Grover Norquist, of course, the man who got lots and lots of Republicans to sign his no new taxes pledge. Republican Alan Simpson wasn't too kind to Grover Norquist in his words last week before the committee. Here he is.
Just a quick note about Grover Norquist. If Grover Norquist is now the most powerful man in America, he should run for president. There's no question about his power, and let me tell you, he has people in thrall. That's a terrible phrase. Lincoln used it. It means your mind has been captured. You're in bondage with the soul.
Alan Simpson on Grover Norquist last week. Felicia Somnath, please stand by. Howard Fineman joins us right now, former senior Washington correspondent with Newsweek magazine, now editorial director at AOL Huffington Post Media Group. Howard, thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to do it. Sorry for the long title and former title.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of title. It's a lot of deficit, too. We thought this was supposed to be structured in such a way that it was do or die. Was that just window dressing? Is this just float by and we go right on down the deficit river?
Well, it's sort of like the Congress tried to handcuff itself in order to force itself to do something. But of course, they handcuffed themselves, but also always have the key to unlock the handcuffs. And they can do what they want even after the so-called triggers go into effect and try to untrigger them with additional votes down the line. So this has always been sort of like an artificial, internally imposed crisis, which is why they're probably not going to reach a deal.
And we wonder why the American public looks at Congress with the lowest approval ratings maybe ever. Felicia, what we're hearing is that Democrats have actually proposed a $3 trillion cut, more than double what's required here over 10 years, and entitlement cuts within that have got some Democrats very unhappy, but that it includes some increased tax revenues the Republicans so far just haven't signed off on. Is that true?
That's true. And basically, both parties came out over the past 2 weeks with their own, sort of after deliberating internally, they came out with their own proposals that they brought to the broader group. The tricky thing is that both of those proposals were, of course, political and in no ways were meant to be the final deal that the committee could agree on. Republicans brought forth a plan that would enact about $2.2 trillion in deficit savings over the next decade. And in that plan was only about $40 billion in new revenue. So they hadn't really budged much at all from the summer in their opposition to any revenue increases in this. And Democrats, when they came out with their deal, as you mentioned, it was about $3.2 trillion in deficit savings. So well above and beyond what the minimum amount for the super committee is to achieve. But included in there was $1.3 trillion in new taxes. Now, the question is, Democrats are sort of spinning their proposal in a way to say, well, we put entitlements on the table. Included in their plan was about almost $500 billion in cuts to federal health programs such as Medicare, Medicaid. Okay. And they took a lot of heat from their base on that, and labor groups came out against that, and a whole bunch of Democrats and groups on the left are basically up in arms saying that their party gave away too much too early in this negotiation. But now what that allows the Democrats to do is sort of point the finger at Republicans and say, well, we've been willing to take this heat and put forward a plan that we think is serious. Where is the plan that is coming from your side? And so you're seeing now a lot of Democratic leaders on the Hill. Harry Reid is pointing the finger at Grover Norquist. It's definitely still in the political stages here, and it may be until next week that we finally see a real movement on a real plan.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the last days of the high-wire work of the Congressional Super Committee on the American Deficit. What's going on behind those closed doors and what it means for the country. Felicia Sanmez of The Washington Post is with us. Howard Fineman from Huffington Post. We'll hear in just a moment from Republican Congressman Tom Cole of Oklahoma. Economist Alan Sinai joins us in a moment as well. But first, from Moore, Oklahoma, Congressman Tom Cole joins us right now. Republican, represents Oklahoma's 4th District. He was one of the 100 representatives, 60 Democrats, 40 Republicans, who last week sent a letter to the Supercommittee urging them to consider all options for a deficit reduction agreement. Widely interpreted that as spending cuts and new revenue taxes if necessary. Congressman Cole, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom, good to be with you.
Do you think there's still a chance that we'll get a real $1.2 trillion or more deal out of this committee, Congressman?
I really do. I think the committee is working very hard on a bipartisan basis. And frankly, I think that they know that if we don't get a deal, two things are going to happen. One, we'll have sequestration, which will cut the money anyway, and we'll do it in a very inefficient and thoughtless manner. That is basically across the board, half defense, half domestic discretionary spending. Very little in entitlements where the real problem, I think, is. And second, Congress will look dysfunctional. And so if we're going to cut the money anyway, we might as well be smart about it. We might as well try to do it in a way that actually helps the American people have some confidence in their political institutions and leadership.
I wish you'd listen with us for just a moment, Congressman, to your House Speaker, John Boehner. Over the weekend, he was on ABC's This Week with Christiane Amanpour, and she asked him, he was talking late last week about there being room for revenue here, taxes maybe, despite the sort of solid wall against that or what's been seen as that. Here's John Boehner and a little bit of Amanpour.
I believe that if we restructure our tax code, where on the corporate side and the personal side, the target would be a top rate of 25%. It would make our economy more competitive with the rest of the world. It would put Americans back to work. We'd have broader base on the tax rules. And out of that, there would be real economic growth and more revenues for the federal government.
Do you agree at all that there should be any kind of tax increases?
I believe that we can create revenue out of fixing our tax code, and bring that revenue to the table as long as our colleagues on the other side of the aisle are serious about cutting spending.
House Speaker, Republican John Boehner, over the weekend. Now, Tom Cole, what do you make of that? Is that a real openness to increase tax revenues, or is that kind of, you know, shining everybody on while we stay stuck here?
I think it's very much an openness. The Speaker's been, I think, very consistent and very clear about this. Even though there was the effort between the Speaker and the President to reach, quote, the grand bargain this summer didn't work out, both sides acknowledge that Speaker Boehner put $800 billion in new revenue over a 10-year period on the table. Now, we don't know what all the elements of that $800 billion were, but we know each side agreed that it was real. So I think that's been pretty consistently where Speaker Boehner has been. Again, that doesn't necessarily signal a raise in tax rates. Actually, you could have a lowering of tax rates, but you would certainly have to get rid of a lot of the exemptions and credits and what have you. There's over $1 trillion of them in the tax code, and that's the most fruitful place for new revenue.
Is the no new taxes pledge that a lot of Republicans have signed standing in the way of getting this deal done?
No, I actually think what's standing in the way is, so far, the unwillingness of the Democrats to really give very much on the entitlement front. If the president got every new tax that he asked for, that amounts to about $880 billion over a decade, certainly a lot of money. But according to the Congressional Budget Office, we have a $10 to $11 trillion shortfall in that period between the revenue that will come in and the expenditures that will go out. So literally any deal is going to have to be 8 or 90% at least reduction in spending or reform of entitlements if it's really going to make much of a dent in our deficit problem.
Democrats say they've put a $3.2 trillion reduction on the table, and it's not flying because Republicans won't take the $1 trillion or so in new revenues that it would bring.
Well, of course, a third in new revenues is simply, that's a lot more of new revenue than proportionally we're going to have to deal with to actually fix. I think we ought to focus on the spending side of this first. But again, I recognize we're in a negotiation process. The Democrats put it on the table. They clearly wanted to make a talking point out of it because they basically released it, I think. And that's fine. Each side, the Republicans responded with a $2 trillion plus package worth of cuts. The reality is neither side is going to get everything that they want in a discussion and a debate like this. The Democrats control the presidency and the Senate. We control the House. That's a pretty good prescription that neither side is going to get exactly what they want because neither side can simply impose its will on the other.
Here's a warning from former Republican Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico, your neighbor there, last week, that a failure to compromise here could bring on disaster.
If we don't do this, those who are for fixing health care and those who are for tax increases, and they say we'll do not one without the other, we will do only one, then they are both complicit in letting America destroy itself, letting this great democracy destroy itself because we don't want to make tough decisions.
Are we marching toward the cliffs of Greece here, Congressman Cole?
Well, I think we're in a very serious situation, and I think Senator Domenici is right to point it out. There are a lot of dangerous possibilities in front of us unless we act. And I think, again, this requires being tough on the revenue side, that is being willing to look at things like new revenue as long as it's coming through, as the Speaker suggests, reforms in the tax code. But it also requires confronting entitlements, and I think that's the hard thing to do. Look, we simply can't sustain the entitlement programs that we have on the tax structure that we have, and they're going to require some reforms. Doesn't have to affect anybody that's on them now, anybody that's in the near term approaching them, but we're going to have to make some changes if we're going to be able to pay for them, and frankly, make sure that we have Social Security and Medicare for future generations.
Representative Tom Cole, Republican Congressman from Oklahoma's 4th District, joining us from Moore, Oklahoma today. Congressman Cole, thanks very much for your time.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Howard Fineman, give us a little interpretation there. Do you hear daylight there, running room for some kind of compromise here or not?
Well, I hear it from the congressman, who is an eminently reasonable person. At least he sounds that way, and I think he is. The problem is that the tone that you heard from him is rare on the Hill. Everybody's playing to their base. Everybody's looking to score points. We don't know what's going on inside the room. I think that the members of the committee are, for the most part, very serious about trying to do something, but they're being tugged and pulled in all directions. And frankly, the White House and the president are, for the most part, on the sidelines here, from what I can tell. Felicia may have different reporting, but I think the White House is keeping hands off and having been deeply involved in direct negotiations before, the president is staying away this time. Maybe that's a good idea politically, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Felicia, give us that. If the White House is hands off, why would that be? Do they think failure here somehow works for them, or they don't see a hope of success, or what?
Yes, well, absolutely. One thing that's made this spending fight really different from what we saw play out over the summer is that the White House absolutely does not have a seat at the table here. And in fact, they're quite happy to let these 12 members of Congress sort of hash this out amongst themselves. And with the knowledge that if it's a very, very tough task that the supercommittee faces, and if they're not able to come to an agreement now, that's unfortunate because the debt ceiling legislation that went through this summer basically gives them the best shot that Congress has ever had at moving forward with this kind of deal. It would fast track it through both chambers. We would know pretty soon by, I think it's the December 23rd is the deadline that both chambers would have to act on this. So it would just zoom right through there, no amendments, and you know, both sides would basically be spared a lot of the political difficulty that otherwise surrounds this issue. The downside to that, though, is that, as we mentioned earlier, the stick really isn't big enough, and it might have to wait until later on. The next debt ceiling fight that happens after the next election will be back at the same spot again. And Republicans that I've talked to on the Hill have said that they believe that they really have fundamentally changed the debate over debt in the country. And just as we saw in August, anytime there's going to be another raising of the debt ceiling, Republicans are going to be asking for a commensurate cut in overall spending. So when that next debate rolls around, maybe that will be the time that both parties will come and finally work on a $4 trillion deal. And one other point that I think is interesting to make too is that Congressman Cole was sounding a much more positive note in terms of compromise on taxes. And everyone is talking about, let's simplify the tax code. But look at what Congress is actually doing right now. One of the issues that's on their agenda is a tax credit for businesses to hire unemployed veterans. Mm. So even while everyone is saying that we would really like to, you know, streamline the tax code and take a really good shot at comprehensive tax reform, what they're doing on the Hill is quite different from that.
And here we've got these warnings of apocalypse from Simpson and Bowles and Domenici. I want to get an economist view of this. Let's get a couple callers here first. Augusta, Georgia, Gail is calling. Hi, Gail, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. I had three little points to make, and I'll take my comments off the air. First, there's always the rhetoric that basically the Republicans give us, which are that not cutting taxes on the rich are going to create jobs, and which is fine, but I wish they would please make up a list of the jobs that have been created that stayed in the United States and employed workers there, because if you don't say what jobs, then how does anyone know what they are?
Gail, take us to the heart of it, Gail. I want to get the heart of what you've got to say here. Is it on the tax front? Taxes for whom? What?
Taxes, yes. Well, yes. And count the number of the congressmen and senators against new taxes on those over $1 million a year, and see how many of those people are millionaires.
Well, we know it's a pretty good number in the Senate in particular. Let us hold that for a second. Gail, I appreciate your call. One more, Van Horn, Iowa. Tom's calling. Tom, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. My comment is everybody keeps talking about entitlements, and what they don't say is they call Social Security an entitlement now. I've paid half of that, and every contractor or employer I've ever worked for has paid the other half. So I don't feel like I'm entitled to it, but I've paid for it. It's not like a giveaway that they're trying to say it is now. And the third rail of politics used to be Social Security. Now it's defense. Nobody wants to cut defense. It's like a bottomless pit we keep shoveling money into, and they don't even know where it all goes.
Well, a lot of people do, though. I mean, even the Pentagon, you know, Bob Gates, before he left as defense secretary, said it's time to do some cutting there. But how much, I guess, is the question. Tom, let me ask you, if you're asked to take some trim on Social Security, given the fiscal situation that we're looking at, would you consider any trim on that at all to be out of bounds? Or are you willing to give a little to help get things in balance here?
Well, it depends. If the millionaires that got their tax cuts in 2001 that were supposed to sunset in 2010, then they held Obama hostage on that with an extension of unemployment benefits, but they haven't created any jobs in 10 years, and they had all this money rolling in. So why doesn't that sunset like it was supposed to? Because Republicans keep protecting millionaires. They don't want any extra taxes, but yet they want to take it out of my pocket, which is very small and practically empty, and take my Social Security from me.
Doesn't leave you in the mood to take a trim there, and we hear that, Tom. Let's get an economist voice in here. Alan Sinai joins us. He's chief global economist, strategist, and president of Decision Economics. Alan Sinai, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have
you. Hello, Tom.
So let's go first to those warnings we heard from Alan Simpson, Erskine Bowles, Pete Domenici. Really kind of apocalyptic. Do this now. This will be disastrous for the country if we don't seize this opportunity. Clock's ticking. We've got 2 weeks and a couple of days left, max. Do you see the stakes as high as that or not, Alan, as an economist looking on here?
Right. For the long run, the stakes are extremely high. We should take all the action we can take now while we have the opportunity, while the debate is hot. In terms of the apocalyptic aftermath of this whole thing, no, I don't agree with them. They're much, much too scary in what they say.
Why? I mean, we're looking at Europe. It looks very scary right now. You look at Greece, you look at Italy, you look at contagion.
We have all those parameters that the sovereign debt-ridden European countries have that are in trouble now. We've had all these characteristics for years. So I said this is really – stakes are high for our long-run place in history. This is a defining moment for our country. That's why we should deal with it now in the way that Simpson and Bowles are saying.
Mm-hmm.
And Congress should really step up to it. And I think they will – not fully, but they will step up to it and deal with it. We should do it because the long-run stakes are for our country and our future are huge. But in the near term, the kind of disaster, apocalypse, collapse, total collapse in financial markets, no, that would not happen.
Look at last summer. We had everything right on the cliff here when the Congress wouldn't sign off on, you know, raising the debt ceiling. And now, was that just an artificial crisis or are we tiptoeing toward a real crisis?
Markets do what markets do. Notice,
well, that was Congress driving that,
but
though.
Congress, markets will get involved in the things that are going on, like Greece and Europe and the issues in Italy now. And what is going on here in the markets will be very preoccupied with this over the next couple of weeks. But the volatility in markets is not real.
Not real.
No.
Even around Europe or the U.S.?
What is real is that we have a huge deficit we have to fix, and the sooner we fix it, the better off we are.
Look at the interest rates Italy is paying now. They're through the roof. That's a heavy burden.
That isn't going to happen right away here, even if they came to no agreement and we had a sequester, which I doubt will be the case.
The sequester across the board cuts.
Yeah, I don't think that will happen. That's too punitive for them. Congress understands how unhappy America is with Washington.
How do you think they
will
get out of that? How will they get out of that?
Well, they'll give us a plan with a lot of blanks and a blueprint for the future, which we will settle in the election of next year, depending on the candidates, what they tell us they're going to do on this issue. And we're going to vote for that, and we'll have a healthy one-year debate on it. But we aren't going to do $4 trillion in a plan that comes out in 2 weeks. We'll probably have a blueprint for something like $1.5 or $2 trillion, including what they passed in August, and that will forestall the apocalypse and give us more time to deal with it.
Felicia Sunmez, is that the way you see it? This committee wraps it up. It's, you know, this huge drum roll. Then before Thanksgiving, they give us just kind of a blueprint full of blanks and say, hey, country, you work it out during the presidential election year. Is that possible?
That's absolutely a possibility, and the political benefit of that for both sides is that it lets them continue making the case along the campaign trail as we head into 2012, which is a big year. But on Alan's point about whether the super committee fails and how markets might respond to that, I find it very interesting because the assumption here on Capitol Hill anyway is that the worst thing that could happen possibly is for this committee to fail. And Congress's approval rating already at 9% could even inch lower than that if possible. But in terms of what the markets might do and economically, there's any number of outside analysts who say that this might not be such a bad thing because, as we've talked about, the $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction will happen no matter what. So that could end up being worst thing politically, maybe not such a bad thing economically.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the work of the Congressional Super Committee that was sent off last summer to get something big done in a hurry on the American deficit. The axe hanging over all that. If they don't, big across-the-board cuts are supposed to kick in. Now, we've got just a couple weeks remaining and no puff of smoke yet on a big deal coming out there. Lots of response online at our website, onpointradio.org. Neil says, I'm not holding my breath. $1.2 trillion is not nearly enough. We all need to share the sacrifice. Prairie writes, it used to be called brinksmanship. Now we're facing a degree of childishness, self-importance, and irresponsibility in those we elect to Congress. And Simple says, we don't need a Democratic plan or a Republican plan. We need an American plan. Well, what will that be? Howard Feynman of the AOL Huffington Post Media is with us today. Alan Sinai, chief global economist at Decision Economics, is here. Dory is calling from Mansfield, Connecticut. Hi, Dory. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Mm-hmm. I've been concerned about all this, you know, for some time because of the way it seems to be the case that the poor and people who don't have nickels and dimes get nickeled and dimed. But on the issue of the supercommittee itself, I've heard, you know, and watched the internet carefully on this issue.
Yeah.
And the talk right now is of an occupied supercommittee that's about to take place on November 9th in Washington, D.C. And I'm sure what will come up there are the details of how the American people's voice could be heard and how the American people could be better informed. And finally, you know, one of the big issues here, we're talking about cutting people's, you know, benefits, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Why not instead stop Wall Street speculating in health care, which drives up these costs? And, you know, you had an economist, Alan Sinai, I agree. You know, a lot of what's going on Wall Street is speculation. So it drives up health care costs, and it's totally unnecessary. It's vapor. Things don't need to be that expensive, you know, drugs, medical devices, et cetera.
Dory, I appreciate your call. Let me take it, Howard Feynman, first to you. I mean, occupy the super committee. Okay, and there will be members there really paying attention to that. Tea Party got a lot of people's attention and was big in driving the debate last summer. I mean, how do you see Congress, if their concerns, if their nerve endings, or Howard, are sort of channeling up to the super committee, how do you see them reading what's going on in this country with their super low approval rating, with people's unease? Alan Sinai says, you know, catastrophe doesn't kick in right away here, but people don't want this to be kicked down the road forever.
No, they don't. And I think the members of the super committee, which after all include people such as Senator John Kerry, who knows the country well, having run for president, having been the Democratic standard bearer, don't forget, a few years ago. I mean, I think they're aware of the public dissatisfaction. They're aware of the crisis that we face long term in terms of a national debt that's just intolerably large, and the risks that that poses. And yet they're locked in the politics of the moment because that's the way things work here. They're pulled apart by conflicting political concerns. And again, to mention the White House again, and a lot of the Democrats, the last thing they want to do is do a deal that would include, quote, tax reform, which would close a bunch of loopholes, but would also, as part of the bargain, lock in the Bush-era tax cuts, at least in theory, forever, and maybe even lower rates, including rates on the wealthy. So you have the president going around the country talking about the 1% versus the 99% and talking about these rich Wall Street bankers and so forth. But if the Democrats were to agree to a deal that would, in the end, really lower rates overall, some theorists would applaud, but the Democratic base would hate it. That's just one example of the kind of sort of centrifugal forces of politics that are at work here.
Alan Sinai, if you can, put politics aside for a moment, if that's possible for anyone in this world. And as an economist, look at this. Can you make a straight-up assessment of whether or not to really cut the deficit, we have to have not just spending cuts but more revenue? Is there a way to take that out of a political conversation and look at it divorced from that? I mean, in a way, everything is political, but as an economist, you're looking at this. Do we need more revenue, period? We've got a lot of boomers who are about to retire and need a lot of service.
Sure. You need both reductions in expenditure and you need more revenues. Not necessarily more and higher tax rates, but more revenues. More revenues. You can get that from a stronger growing economy because after the fact, you can get more revenues. So the composition of any deficit reduction plan, the $1.2 trillion sequester, is bad because it's brutal. A more voluntary $1.5 trillion would be a step in the right direction, even if there are some blanks to be filled in later in the election. It would get us going on that. I think we'll get that from Congress and the super committee with a lot of heat and debate as they make their points for politics, because as Howard says, it's the way the game is played down there in Washington. we don't like the way the game is played in Washington. That's what America is saying. But we can't change that now. But we need to understand they play that game to the last minute. But they'll give us something. Now, the composition should be more expenditure reductions. Entitlements is the real problem. That's the real heart of it, aging population, medical care costs. That's very tough to figure out in a couple of weeks, so there could be a blank to deal with that. And, yeah, revenues have to go up. And as far as revenues on the rich, I understand the argument that half of the millionaires, according to Republicans, are independent small businesses. But, you know, we could let those Bush tax cuts expire on the rich, and they could pay higher taxes. As long as we take those funds and we fund tax cuts for other people who can do something with the money permanently and don't use the increased receipts to fund unnecessary expenditures. So the
ratio, what do you call unnecessary? Our caller, Tom, in Iowa. He's paid into Social Security. He wants Social Security.
I know. Not Social Security. Not for me. That's a societal question as to what that is. It's very hard to separate out the societal issues from the economics. On the economics of it, expenditure reductions on the order of 3-1 or 50-50 equal expenditure reductions against tax increases with a chunk taken out over 10 years of the deficit. $1.5 trillion is a little light.
Yep. But
$2 to $2.5 trillion would be enough
on
of a
road,
step on
somewhere.
The road
mm-hmm.
Is, I think, the way to go. The problem is when you talk about any kind of expenditure reduction or a tax increase like the one I just said, let mm-hmm. the tax rates expire on the so-called rich. Not at $250,000. That's too low. That's a mistake by the Obama administration. Should be higher in terms of where the dividing line is. Then immediately you're into politics. You're into politics. It's very hard, if not impossible.
No, you're never going to avoid it in the end.
Separate it out.
But if that happened, would that be significant? Higher taxes on, 300 plus or 400,000 plus or you name it. Is that significant? Does that really help us get to a $2 trillion deal?
Actually, there's quite a bit of revenue that comes out of letting the tax cuts expire for just $1 million and up. But my own dividing line is something like $750,000 to let those tax cuts expire. But
surely that population could afford it if that would really help us get things fixed. But then there's the Republican push and Grover Norquist, all the rest saying no way, no how. Let me get a caller right here, if I may, Ellen. Sangeeta in Columbia, South Carolina. Sangeeta, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a great suggestion right now. Since Republicans have signed the pledge to Norquist, maybe we really don't need any government or anything. We can have three people running this whole country. One is Glover Marquist and two Koch brothers. Apparently, Koch brothers got plenty and plenty of money. They can run the whole country without anybody's taxes, so we really don't need any taxes.
Sangeeta, we've got it. Grover Norquist and the Koch brothers can run the whole thing. Howard, what about Republicans' room for maneuver on this? It's not just Grover. They've got angry Tea Party people at their back who don't, and Koch brothers,
yes,
who don't want higher taxes. Now, here's 40 of this 100 Congress people signed a letter saying, come on, let's look at everything here. Is there some running room that may not have been evident right after the midterms for Republicans now or not?
You had those 40 Republican House members
yeah.
doing that. But if I'm not mistaken, there are also 33 Republican senators.
The Senate saying no, thank you.
Saying no how, no way,
mm-hmm.
no time
mm-hmm.
To any net new revenues, in other words,
yep.
any net revenue increases. So that sort of captures the dilemma of the Republican Party. And you've got all their candidates, all the Republican candidates for the nomination running around swearing up and down that they'll never raise taxes of any kind in any way. And so, yes, the Tea Party is at the back and under the, lighting a fire, so to speak, under the Republicans. And that's one reason why they're where they are. And that's one reason why I say a voice like that of Congressman Cole is so rare in American politics today, because the two parties are almost entirely creatures of their bases and are speaking to their bases and their contributors and not speaking to each other. It's almost as though, if you can picture the House of Parliament, in the House of Commons in Britain, where the parties face each other, we've got a situation in American politics where you take all those benches and turn them around
And they're in the same room, but they're speaking beyond the walls. They're not speaking to each other.
And so here we look at it. How do we get beyond this, Alan? Do we have to wait for the stakes to get palpably higher, for the financial world to come in and start, you know, banging on our interest rates and pushing them up? Do you see some margin of Republicans willing now to step up and do what's necessary here, enough Democrats?
I think the movement, which is represented by the 100 congressman letter that we've talked about, is a move in the right direction. I saw John Boehner in the interview with Christiana, and mm-hmm. I think he's open to higher tax revenues. They just don't want to raise tax rates. Like they would turn down my suggestion of letting the higher rates expire, the Bush tax rates go back to what they were, higher rates for high-income Americans. There is something to the tax reform, cutting our corporate taxes. There's commonality there to a lower rate and eliminating loopholes. And if that would be appealing to the Republicans aren't getting what they need from the Obama administration and the Democrats on entitlements, which is really where the big hole is. I think in the next 2 weeks, we're going to get a rush toward something that will give us enough out of this so that 6 months from now, we'll be back here debating a lot of the same issues, having moved a step down the road.
What's
in the context of the presidential election?
What's enough from the Democrats, to your point of view?
From the point of view of the markets.
Saying $3.3 over 10 years.
Well, let me talk about the Armageddon kind of scenarios and Greek-like. We are Greek-like. If we go this way long enough, we'll be like Greece. We'll be like Chile. We'll be like Brazil, like all the banana republics were in the past.
And I'm looking at the Washington Post here, editorial page, saying, look, it's Republicans, barring the door here with the refusal. Well, I mean, I don't know who's right, but that's
politics. I must tell you that both sides are contributing in the game of Washington that Howard described so well, which is to win the next election, to talk, as he said, beyond the room to their constituencies and not to each other. When the axe gets closer, they'll talk to each other and they will give us something. We've been through this dance again and again. I'm fed up with it. You're fed up with it. America's fed up with it. We have nobody to represent us. So the game goes on the way it goes on. We will get something out of the game that will forestall Armageddon. And we'll be back here in the context of the presidential election, dealing with issues of tax reform. How do we do it? Dealing with health care. How do we do it? And let us hope that whoever the candidates are, we know it'll be Obama, and I don't know the Republicans, that we will get a clear-cut plan and more debate and discussion that will fill in those blanks that I'm talking about. And we will get to what we ultimately have to get to, which is for our life and our future in the world. $4 trillion, as Bowles and Smith said, over the 10 years of serious deficit reduction with some mix of expenditures. And yes, we're going to have tax, higher taxes as well. That means we all will suffer some. We can't have it every which way.
So the presidential election is a kind of referendum on what the country needs to do not to go down that Greek road. Sam in Revere, Massachusetts. Sam, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, great conversation. I'm a little bit more pessimistic. Absolutely nothing will change until there's more pressure on the government. It's not a Democrat or Republican issue. It's a 1%, 99% issue. So I think the only hope is something for, like, the Occupy movement getting a lot bigger. I mean, the last time things were really okay in this country were really the result of the New Deal. And that was pushed through because people were out on the street. And, I think the good news is things are going to get much worse. There were no reforms of the financial sector at all.
That's good news, Sam?
Yeah, I think so, because the only hope for America is for things to get worse, because government is not going to do it, because it's totally in the pocket of the corporations and the banks.
Well, so I hear you, but there's so much personal pain on that road, you'd like to think that our elected representatives could get it done without that kind of meltdown. Hey, Howard, do you think that the Congress will actually pull away the bite of this axe that's supposed to come down? Will they say, no, we were just kidding about that. We may not get something done, but no, we don't, we won't let all that sequestration happen. We won't take that bite out of the Pentagon's budget. Will they just say, no, we were just fooling?
I think that's entirely possible. They won't call it that. They won't admit it in that way. But as Alan said, the sort of meat axe nature of what the sequestration would do would call on the Congress to try to fix various egregious parts of that. And once they head down the road of fixing the egregious parts, who's to say what isn't egregious? And they could amend, you know, whatever Congress, whatever law Congress passes, whatever internal procedures it decides upon, it can change. And so I think that you could see that happen.
What about a plan with blanks and then the presidential election as a referendum for the citizens to decide how it is they want to achieve these cuts?
Well, but yes, but the presidential election in part is going to be based on raising fears about what the other side would do as opposed to proposing a reasonable sweeping plan. President Obama is not who has to, if you look at the Electoral College, has to win, has to be competitive in and try to win Florida and Ohio, just to pick out two states, and Pennsylvania, state with a very old age population. Do you think he's really going to propose $1 trillion worth of cuts in entitlements before the election? I doubt it.
And so we have the possibility of sitting there with what should be a referendum instead of being what? A kind of a battle of symbolism without getting down in those trenches to figure it out?
Yeah, the real deal won't happen until after the next presidential election.
Somehow I'm not feeling real easy about this. I think the polls make it pretty clear Americans aren't either, but we've got some insight here on where this may be going. Howard Fineman, formerly with Newsweek, now with AOL Huffington Post. It's great to have you with us, Howard. Thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And Alan Sinai, chief global economist at Decision Economics. Thank you very much, Alan, for coming in.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us in Chicago. Welcome. Great to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.